Good day, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Rapid Case Review. As today, we'll review actual cases of metastatic urothelial bladder cancer. We're visited today by Dr. Matt Malowski from the University of North Carolina Lindberger Comprehensive Cancer Center in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. In preparation for our program today, I met with two urologic medical oncologists, Dr. Nazli Disman from the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, Texas, and Dr. Jacqueline Brown from the Emory University School of Medicine in Atlanta, Georgia. And both of these physicians presented cases to me of metastatic urothelial bladder cancer that we're going to be discussing today with Dr. Malowski. So, Matt, here's the first case from Dr. Disman.
60-year-old female executive. She had muscle-invasive bladder cancer in the past and received neoadjuvant cisplatin-based chemotherapy and underwent radical cystectomy and with pathology showing YPT1N0 with no nodal disease or and with negative margins. Within 8 months of surgery, she was found to have a new 2.5-centimeter right upper lung nodule and the right hilar lymph node measuring 1.7 centimeter. Both were biopsied and proven to be metastasis from bladder primary. She was started on enfortumab vedotin plus pembrolizumab as first-line strategy, and she had a near complete radiographic response, so just millimetric disease, after 5 months of therapy. She's actually tolerating this treatment well with only minimal toxicity plus very mild side effects. The cumulative effect of mild side effects are impacting her ability to travel, and she needs to travel 6 more months until she gives over her business to a family member. So for this case, we have a patient with oligometastatic disease who had an excellent response to therapy. Do we ever consider consolidative radiation for patients with bladder cancer and oligometastatic disease if they have response or if any cases? In addition to that, I also wanted to see if this would allow us to stop treatment and give patients a treatment-free interval that we see in other cancers with immunotherapy-based combinations.
Any other questions about this case?
Well, I would like to discuss how concerned they are about the neuropathy side effect of EV Pembro that may limit administration of chemotherapy in further lines. Should we be concerned? Should we expect it to persist? Our patients could be very frail, and neuropathy is a very, very scary side effect. So a lot of us are very cautious, and we try to detect it early, but also we worry when we start these medications. For the major side effects with enfortumab vedotin, if you could give us a brief overview of how you approach treatment interruption, treatment dose reduction, and treatment discontinuation for major side effects of these treatments, that would be great.
The story is probably not a rare one. I'm curious what your thoughts are about how to manage patients with, I guess you can say, oligometastatic disease.
Yeah, so I think that, you know, it's very reasonable to consider that if you have better systemic therapy that is able to control disease and you develop or have oligometastatic disease or oligoprogression and disease is otherwise controlled, that it may be very reasonable to consider radiation therapy under those circumstances. Obviously, we have seen this used in other diseases with more robust data than we have in urothelial cancer, although we do have more data in urothelial cancer that's been emerging that's retrospective. But certainly in prostate cancer, right, in kidney cancer, we've seen roles for the use of treatment of oligometastatic or oligoprogressive disease. So I think that there was data presented at ASCO 2025, sort of retrospective data looking at this with promising sort of progression-free and survival outcomes. I think that under the circumstances, sure, I think it'd be reasonable in the absence of significant morbidity associated with the radiation that you're going to use. If it's SBRT, it's often extremely well tolerated. Why not give it a shot in the setting, again, of systemic therapy that is so much better able to control the disease as compared to what we have had historically?
So this patient seems like she didn't really have that much of an issue with side effects, although it was enough that it was bothering her because she needed to travel, et cetera. What about this issue of treatment interruption and just observing patients? And it kind of ties into length of therapy, but also retreatment, you know, sort of treatment holidays. You ever consider doing that? And can you talk a little bit about your experience? She asks about peripheral neuropathy. Again, what do you say to patients who are about to get started on treatment? And what do you do with patients with pre-existing neuropathy? Maybe you have type 2 diabetes, they already have some neuropathy. How do you factor that into how you treat and manage patients?
Yeah. So great points. You know, neuropathy is one of the most significant, if not the most significant, toxicity associated with enfortum epidotin. We saw it in all of the studies, you know, starting in, you know, EB-103. The issue is that the way the neuropathy is typically presented, it's predominantly peripheral sensory neuropathy. Depending upon the study you look at, the rates with monotherapy may be in the range, this is all grade, of about 45-50%, whereas it's slightly over 60% in EB-302 in combination with pembrolizumab. If you look at the grade 3, which is what is otherwise reported, Neil, it's typically, you know, less than 10% in the 5 to 7% range. The problem is grade 2, because, you know, as you know, as a medical oncologist, grade 2 is a problem for patients. Grade 2 is moderate. It interferes with instrumental activities of daily living. But most importantly, and I've talked with my friend and colleague Ethan Bash about this, who's an expert in patient-reported outcomes and PRO-CTCAEs, that this grade 2 is something that is of moderate to severe, okay, in terms of intensity, pain that patients can experience, extremely bothersome to the patient, and really interferes with their daily activities. That's grade 2. And so when we see grade 2, we need to hold. And you need to hold, you need to wait till that resolves to less than or equal to grade 1. There are recommendations that you can restart at the same dose. If it happens again, you should dose reduce. I think, again, it depends on the patient. There are circumstances where I certainly dose reduce up front. And I do think you have to be important. We know that underlying diabetes with peripheral neuropathy or idiopathic peripheral neuropathy can be more of an issue for these patients. And so, again, I think close monitoring of these patients, you know, certainly a lot of times they're doing well. They are reluctant to report more significant peripheral neuropathy. You've got to really push them on those motor because that does happen. You know, I mean, can you button your shirt? You know, are you having issues with some of those instrumental ADLs? And so it is a critical part of taking care of patients who are receiving enfortumab.
So, you know, also you have to take into account the potential benefit of therapy. You're talking about maybe, you know, seeing a tail on the curve, you know, really some great benefits. And I'm sure there are plenty of people out there who start out with grade 2 neuropathy from diabetes or some other cause right from the beginning. And it maybe also brings in the issue of patient involvement in difficult decisions. So for a patient like that who can understand it, at least involving them, I could imagine people with pretty bad neuropathy who still might want to try EV Pembro, but you tell me.
Yeah, I was in the office yesterday seeing patients and had this conversation with one of our fellows and one of our patients who's been on enfortumab for many cycles. And, you know, we've had multiple dose holds. Enfortumab been dose reduced to 0.75 mg per kg. She continues to want to stay on therapy. She's had some episodes of oligoprogression that we've actually treated with SBRT. She's been on treatment just overall for many years with metastatic disease, not just enfortumab, but other treatments. It's absolutely remarkable. And so absolutely need to involve the patient, absolutely need to consider, you know, things like PRO-CTCAEs to really understand what's going on with these patients, if you can incorporate that or embed that within your clinical practice. But patient involvement, like in any situation, is extremely important, necessary to be able to, you know, manage the expectations of the patient, but make them aware that, again, you can dose reduce And really, the exposure response data relates to the early cycles.
What about, you know, treatment holidays as opposed to treatment discontinuation, just trying people off therapy for a while? Do you ever do that?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think we all do that. You know, we have patients that go on holidays for periods of time, you know, either as related to toxicity or in the context of having had major responses to therapy. Again, there's not really great data to be able to know specifically how to do this. Folks have been trying to look and design studies to actually look at the question of EV discontinuation in those major responders. But, you know, I think those would be important trials to do. But in some ways, the horse is out of the barn. So it's been complicated because folks are obviously doing that in the clinical practice. But it would be absolutely wonderful to have sort of an EV discontinuation type trial to really understand how to do that in a consistent way among patients with bladder cancer.
You got to wonder whether cell-free DNA is ever going to have a role in these kind of decisions, but we'll see. Let's move on to the next case. This is from Dr. Brown, a 74-year-old man. Here's the case.
He's 74. He's got muscle-invasive disease. He's got a ton of variant histologies in the mix, right? He had 65% UC, but there was squamous, there was sarcomatoid, there was a little glandular. He had bilateral lymphadenopathy in his pelvis up to his common iliac. I started him on EV and Pembro. And so all the while, he has next-gen sequencing cooking and IHC cooking. His HER2 comes back as 3+. But of course, he's already on EVP, and I think that's the right first-line decision. He was clinically debilitated early on. He's one of those patients where I just was thinking, do I have the runway to get enough treatment into him, or have I lost my window? He got hospitalized with a UTI a couple times, and it was just like he was melting before my eyes. So ultimately, I saw him 3 months into treatment, and he looked like a new man. He had gained 10 pounds. He was like, I can move around. I was seeing him in a wheelchair, and I started seeing him with a walker. That was months ago. And at this point, this last visit, he was no walker. He's like, I don't need one. He's going back to church, which was really important to him. And he's a really social guy. And he's like, I have my life back. And he's with his son all the time. And it's just, he has come back to life. And he's had some side effects, a little neuropathy, which I sort of put my claws into him every visit. And I'm like, are you sure? Are you sure it's only grade one? And he's like, yeah, no problem, doc. And he's got itchy skin, and I give him topical steroids, but has done great. And clinically, I mean, had a PR on his first scans. I expect more of the same given how well he's doing clinically. I think a really big question in the EVP era is, one, like, that's technically pelvis localized disease, and should there be a role for consolidative surgery in the future for the people who have a really beautiful response if all of that disease melts and he has no evidence of disease? One of the things that's really hard for me is, let's say a year into treatment, you're saying you've had a durable CR. This is fantastic. Well, is that the time for me to say, get the bladder out? I think question of that bulky nodal N2, N3 disease, what do you think about that role for cystectomy? I think everyone agrees not up front because they clearly have a systemic disease, but what do we do when we have better systemic therapies like EVP that are leading to more CRs? How are we going to approach consolidative therapy in the future when we might actually be looking for a cure in these patients? And then with the IHC showing me his HER2 3+, should I be using trastuzumab deruxtecan as my next line? Should I be using platinum doublet? In patients who are HER2 positive, how do we think about platinum doublet versus HER2 targeted therapy as our post-EVP next line therapy, if no trials available?
So 74-year-old man, mixed histology, which I'm really curious what your thoughts are, rapidly going downhill, losing weight, everything turns around, EV, Pembro. You heard about the case and her questions. Any comments?
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, anytime you see subtype divergent differentiation within the tumor, you know, that is generally associated with higher T stage and node positive disease. You know, we worry, of course, about micropapillary and and sarcomatoid and plasmacytoid, but that's just sort of a well-known principle. You see it in upwards of about 30% in terms of subtype and about 15% in terms of divergent differentiation. So again, consistent with what has happened with this disease with extensive nodal involvement. What do you do? So I think EVP, absolutely appropriate here. Of course, you know, we know the data, we've talked about it. I think that the issue of consolidation, you know, Neil, this is not new, right? And again, I'll say you remember this. And if you go back to, there's a paper that was published in 1999 by Dodd and Bajoran. And that paper was a retrospective experience looking at 210 patients treated with MVAC chemotherapy. And what they demonstrated is in 30 patients that had a CR to cystectomy, chemotherapy, and chemotherapy, this is cisplatin-based, again, MVAC, at 5 years, 33% of those patients were alive. So the point being that systemic therapy with a major response, and in that case, it was the major response, and the patients who benefited most were those with local regional disease, nodal disease. So this is a concept that we've known about for a very long time. So it stands to reason, as Dr. Brown said, that if you have better systemic therapy and can harness a major response or even a complete response, then you are in all likelihood going to be able to cure more patients. You know, how many of those patients need consolidative cystectomy? Could you consider chemoradiation therapy? You know, again, maybe some of those patients don't need anything. And I think, you know, tools like ctDNA, you know, better imaging, MR, urine tumor DNA, et cetera, may help ultimately to inform us about what to do with consolidation. There has been an experience, I will say. There was a experience published by the Mayo Clinic, which was, again, looking retrospectively, demonstrating some promising outcomes in a series, I think, that had less than 40 patients with consolidative surgery. And there are some clinical trials that are ongoing trying to address this question, and there are some that are being designed looking at this issue of consolidation in major responders.
So what about this question of the HER2 positivity and what comes next? Assuming the patient would be eligible for example, TDXD, how would you decide whether that would be next, if there is a next? You know, we're talking about GU, ASCO coming up. We just got through, at the beginning of January, GI ASCO. And there, amazingly, first-line therapy of HER2-positive gastroesophageal cancer is going to change because now the bispecific HER2 antibody is zanidatamab is being going to look better than trastuzumab, which they were using. What about first-line therapy of HER2-positive disease urothelial bladder cancer? Are there trials out there looking at TDXD, other HER2 therapies? What about in the adjuvant, neoadjuvant setting? What about other HER2? I think there's another ADC, disatamab vedotin, that's been pretty exciting with HER2. So HER2, urothelial bladder cancer. We'll get more into TDXD with the next case, but just sort of in terms of where things stand in general.
Yeah, I HER2's been something that we've known about for a very long time. Years ago, when I was at Cornell, we did a study that Maha Hussein actually was the principal investigator on, incorporating trastuzumab with chemotherapy. And then it kind of just fell off, you know, and there wasn't a lot of activity, but there was a knowledge that HER2 overexpression was seen in bladder cancer. And this has finally sort of come to fruition. Here we now have a treatment that's approved. There are multiple HER2-targeted agents that are currently being looked at. Disitamab vedotin is an agent that data initially came out of China. There was a large study that was published in combination with toripalimab, which looked very similar to what we see in the EV-302 study, with the exception of a lower complete response rate. But, you know, I think the PFS hazard ratio is like 0.36. And so I think this is absolutely the future. How we select patients for enfortumab versus disitamab and others is ultimately going to be a question that we need to answer. And I suspect that biomarkers will certainly play a major role in those decisions, one would hope. So again, I think a lot of promise for HER2-targeted agents.
Well, let's move on to our last case here. And we've been talking a lot about TDXD, and of course, people in general oncology practice have a lot of experience with TDXD, first in breast cancer, and now in many other cancers. And I think this 68-year-old man capsulizes some of the issues that come up with his treatment, regardless of disease, including urothelial bladder cancer. Here's Dr. Disman.
This gentleman is a 68-year-old man with a 50-pack-year smoking history. He was initially diagnosed with muscle-invasive disease and had received neoadjuvant cisplatin gemcitabine with durvalumab. This was followed by radical cystectomy. The pathology showed YPT2N0 disease, and the patient continued on adjuvant durvalumab. Approximately 6 months into adjuvant treatment, scans showed multiple bilateral pulmonary nodules and retroperitoneal lymph node. The biopsy of the lung lesion confirmed metastatic urothelial carcinoma. He was subsequently started on enfortumab vedotin, which he received for 6 months and unfortunately had progressive disease. HER2 testing for this case from the lung biopsy showed IHC3+ disease, and he was started on trastuzumab deruxtecan. Imaging after treatment initiation showed a partial response with reduction in both lung and the retroperitoneal disease. During treatment, he developed a symptomatic grade 2 interstitial lung disease. This improved following treatment interruption and prolonged corticosteroid taper. He doesn't have any other actionable alterations in the NGS. Now that he had potentially life-threatening side effects from an active treatment, HER2-directed therapy, I wanted to discuss a few things. One of them is the management of ILD with HER2-directed therapy in bladder cancer with trastuzumab deruxtecan. A lot of us are familiar with this side effect from breast cancer. Are there nuances for bladder cancer, given that the patient demographics are very different between two cancer types that we use trastuzumab deruxtecan? And also, would you consider immunotherapy rechallenge in a patient who had received immunotherapy in adjuvant setting and had progression while on immunotherapy? I'm not sure if it's possible, but I just wanted to throw that to you. And if HER2-directed therapies are now contraindicated, do we have only chemotherapy options available, or what clinical trials would you consider? Also, are there any other HER2-directed therapies in development or approved in other cancers that could be considered in these patients who've received HER2-directed therapies in the past, not just as ADCs or bispecifics as well, different therapeutic modalities?
Yeah, I was just wondering whether zanidatamab has been looked at. It was actually got approved in biliary cancer. But anyhow, again, breast cancer has been using T-DXd for a while. They just had a paper at ASCO where they retreated people with grade 1, asymptomatic, and they were able to retreat a lot of people. But in breast cancer, grade 2, which this patient had, symptomatic, any symptoms, they will not treat again. But when I go outside of breast, I don't always hear that story. Lung people are using T-DXd, GI, GU. Not as strongly thought about, but I'm just kind of curious, what's your take on this situation? Not on you. They may be able to watch her for a while, and she just might keep going with this response she's already had from T-DXd. Sometimes you see people who get a short-term treatment toxicity, it stops, and they do well. How would you think through this case? Would you retreat?
I think that with grade 2 interstitial lung disease, pneumonitis associated with T-DXd, I don't think we have enough information in urothelial carcinoma to say we're going to retreat. If you look at the Destiny Pan-Tumor 02 safety summary, I think the pneumonitis rate was in the range of about 10%. Most of it, fortunately, was grade 1-2. But I think we would follow the same protocol that is used in other diseases treated with T-DXd. And so if you have grade 2 symptomatic disease, it results in a permanent discontinuation of T-DXd until we establish more data specific to the disease. I'm not sure, and I don't know enough about this, that there should be differences by disease in terms of the use of the therapy in the context of patients who've had symptomatic pneumonitis and being able to retreat. Obviously, there may be issues that are different in the setting of patients, for example, with lung cancer that receive these types of therapies. But at the moment, I wouldn't retreat.
Another question about TDXD. I'm curious. I always ask people outside of breast cancer, is acute GI toxicity, chemo-like toxicity, nausea and vomiting. Again, the breast cancer people consider it very highly emetogenic, use triple therapy, use a lot of olanzapine, very aggressive about it. But then when I get outside, you know, less experience with TDXD, I'm not really sure. Maybe it's not the same. What's your experience been, and how do you approach this issue when patients are going to get TDXD?
Yeah, it's a really good question because, you know, of course, we in this community have less experience than in patients, you know, that have been receiving this in other diseases. I think, you know, generally for nausea, vomiting during the first cycle and subsequent cycles, if it's adequate, then we use, you know, 5-HT, RAs and dexamethasone. And then if it's inadequate, we use NK1 antagonists with 5-HT3s and dexamethasone, plus or minus olanzapine. And so I think that we sort of follow a similar program for the nausea vomiting prophylaxis. But, you know, again, we may be accumulating more data over time with this agent to be able to better inform, you know, different ways in which to prophylax for nausea and emesis.
It's really interesting with drugs sort of cross treatment or primary tumor site, and you get into different sets of investigators, and they might have different clinical experience than the general oncologist out there. And when we brought in many times to ASCO GU, AUA, like breast cancer investigators by video to talk about their experience with new treatments that are coming into GU. We're doing a program at GU, also a CME program at the GU meeting, on AKT inhibition in prostate cancer. Because as you know, there was a phase 3 study at ESMO of a drug that's used all the time in breast cancer, capivasertib, an AKT inhibitor. I'm not sure whether people are ready to use it or not in prostate cancer, but it's been a challenge. There are issues to deal with. So it's really interesting when you see cross fertilization of input. I guess maybe you talk to your other colleagues there at the UNC Cancer Center.
Yeah, I mean, I do that. And, you know, honestly, for TDXD, what I did is I, you know, went to the breast cancer literature, you know, so there's a great sort of review on managing TDXD-related toxicities by Rugo and ESMO Open in 2022 that I've referred to because at the moment, that's really what we have. And so I tend to try to follow those guidelines until we develop more in the way of specific data with urothelial cancer.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Malowski, and thank you for tuning in. This is Dr. Neil Love for Rapid Case Review.